From our nation's capital, this is Naps Chat.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you.
Hi, this is Bob Levy, the Director of Legislative and Political Affairs for the National Association of Postal Supervisors. Today we have as our guest Jessica Clement, the Vice President for Advocacy for the National Association of Active and Retired Federal Employees, also known as NARF. Welcome to NAPS Chat, Jessica.
Hi, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Now, everyone should know that NAPS and NARF have worked very closely together ever since NARF was first established.
1921.
We've been working together on that because we both represent federal and postal employees and retirees. More recently, we both organizations participate in the Federal Postal Coalition, which was established back in the mid-1980s when FERS was created. In any case, Jessica, one of the issues that we are working on together, which is causing a lot of high blood pressure amongst our members, is the White House budget proposal. There were a number of ideas in the president's proposal that actually would hurt our members. Can you briefly summarize some of them for us?
I can summarize them for you. I'm not quite sure I can do so briefly.
Okay.
The president's FY20 budget looked very similar to the president's FY19 budget. First is a federal pay freeze for federal employees in 2020. I know it doesn't necessarily speak to your members, but certainly a lot of the federal community. The budget proposes increasing retirement contributions for current employees that would affect postal employees for the same pension that is essentially a pay cut. Eliminating the FERS annuity supplement, we've seen this before. Eliminating cost of living adjustments for FERS retirees is not new to the president's budget, but certainly one that is new as an idea for current and future FERS retirees. They would not receive any cost of living adjustment if this were to be signed into law. For the CSRS retirees, their COLA would decrease by 0.5% under the president's budget. COLA this year was 2.8%. CSRS folks in this equation would receive then 2.3%. The budget also proposed changing the rate of return on the Thrift Savings Plan G Fund. It would change how that money is invested. Retirement pensions would move from the highest 3 years of salary to the highest five, high three to high five, something we've talked about for, decades now. And then lastly, what the president's budget proposed was combining sick and annual leave into the same pool. There is a commonly held belief among some that federal leave policies are more generous than private sector benefits and that people want leave all in one pool. So it wouldn't matter if you were sick or on vacation, you just take a day off, doesn't matter the reason. The implications of this, however, have an effect on your annuity as your sick leave is calculated towards your years of service, something that the budget conveniently does not mention. And I think I covered them all and certainly not briefly.
Sure. What a lot of the pressure for pushing these budget cuts has been an escalating budget deficit, which I believe is now up to somewhere around $691 billion as we go halfway through the year 2019. So as we look at this sort of menu of potential attacks against federal and postal employees, which attacks do you think are most serious?
So that's a good question. We have been talking about these for years, and I speak to a lot of NARF members, and I hear all the time, you're telling me the same thing over and over and over again, to which I say, I'm telling you the same thing over and over again because we've been so successful in ensuring these things haven't become law yet. I think the most serious of the president's budget proposals is the federal employee pay freeze. The president has the authority to freeze pay absent congressional action. We saw that at the end of 2018. Congress later overrode that and provided years. So because that one doesn't require legislation, I think that's likely. Out of the other ones, I think some of these are things we've been talking about for a long time, like the increase in retirement contributions, which would impact federal and postal employees. You pay more for the same pension. That's found traction on the Hill in the past. But the budget process on the Hill this year is uncertain at best, I think.
Dysfunctional.
Dysfunctional, most certainly. And it seems in conversations we've had that most members of Congress have resigned themselves to not doing a budget this mm-hmm. year because of that dysfunction. So I'm skeptical that any of these would see any serious traction this year, next year, absent, you know, with the exception of the pay freeze.
Now, time and time again, the increase in contributions to its pension have, in fact, gotten resonance.
Yes.
On both sides of the yep. aisle, because, in fact, the first increase contribution happened under the Clinton administration back in the early 90s, as I recall, during the first Budget Deficit Reduction Act, enacted by Congress when Clinton was president.
Okay. I remember the most recent two were under President Obama, of course, right? Mm-hmm. FERS employees now pay almost six times more for their pension than those hired prior to 2013.
Now, that creates almost a tiered workforce.
A four-tiered workforce.
And that includes postal employees.
Yes.
Now, you were talking about the pay freeze. Now, that would not affect postal employees because postal employees, for the part of particularly for craft employees, that's subject to collective bargaining, and EAS level employees where NAPS members are sort of situated, that's subject to consultation. However, indirectly, Postal Service looks to the pay raise numbers are for the federal employees when it sort of prepares a package for its employees.
Oh, that's really interesting, in which case I'm sure the National Defense Authorization Act is something that maybe your members haven't thought much about before, but may want to now. The NDAA includes the military pay raise. There is an effort underway in the House to provide civilians the same pay raise as the military gets. This was standard practice prior to 2011 when we saw the first federal pay freeze. So I think we're going to see a return to that in the House this year, in which case I'd keep an eye on that NDAA for the military raise.
Sure. Now, let's talk a little bit about what's going on in Congress with regard to the budget.
Okay.
Both budget committees, the House Budget Committee and the Senate Budget Committee, actually reported out budget resolutions. The Senate budget resolution, which is pending on the floor, which has not yet been scheduled for a vote, which may or may not ever be scheduled for a vote, included, I believe, $12 billion of instructions to the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee to reduce programs under its jurisdiction.
$15
billion. $15 billion, yep. I stand
over
corrected.
5 years, too, which was weird, because usually when we see reconciliation instructions, it's over 10. The reconciliation instructions in the Senate budget was 5 years.
5 years, but it's unspecified
yes.
cuts, but there were very limited areas mm-hmm. under the jurisdiction of Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs which could be cut.
Absolutely. Any of the things that you and I talked about at the beginning of this podcast are under the jurisdiction of that committee. And it's not a revenue generating committee. It's not a spending committee. They don't have other places they can go except for cuts to federal pay and benefits, which would mean any one of those cuts that could get them to $15 billion is on the table.
Now, and the House Budget Committee favorably reported its budget resolution last week, and it was supposed to come up for a vote this week, but there's a lot of sort of disagreement amongst the Democratic caucus as to the spending caps, which doesn't really affect retirement issues or health insurance issues per se. It affects more agency spending. But in the absence of a budget resolution being approved by the House or the Senate, it's my understanding that Majority Leader McConnell and Speaker Nancy Pelosi have been talking about going around the committee, the floor structure, to pass a budget resolution and arrange their own budget, a leadership budget.
That doesn't sound complicated at all, does it? That's not ripe for challenges or uprisings from their own parties.
No, but it's interesting that they found a sort of common ground to speak about something.
Hey, they found one.
They found one. But interestingly enough, if they start talking to one another, it's going to probably be a consensus budget that will affect targeted ceilings for particular agencies and won't necessarily go after benefits that our members are concerned about.
You know, that's always a threat in the budget process, right? Particularly with reconciliation instructions. Even if we get out of reconciliation instructions, we're still facing this pesky sequestration, right?
Mm-hmm.
These automatic cuts to agency budgets. And typically over, what, three bipartisan budget agreements so far? Four? There's two-year budget agreements that raise the sequester caps, but they have to find those offsets elsewhere. It was the first of those budget deals where new federal employees saw their retirement contributions increased for the second time in 2 years. So eventually Congress will have to come up with a bipartisan budget agreement. The Speaker and the Majority Leader will get together and say, okay, we're willing to raise the caps by X number of dollars. And that's where I think federal and postal employees and retirees need to pay particular attention, because how are they going to offset those caps, the cap increases?
And also, when they pass such a budget, it will come in the form of an appropriations bill, which has to be signed by the President of the United States to become law. If the President doesn't agree or threatens to shut down the government again, part or all of the government, how's that going to affect our members?
Certainly, everyone's still reeling from that 35-day government shutdown just a few months ago. And I think there is a good likelihood that this could happen again. I mean, conversations that Bob and I have been having with lawmakers, just they've almost resigned themselves to not having a budget by October 1st, let alone appropriations. Technically, you're not supposed to implement appropriations without budget numbers. So the president could get a CR and he could say, nope, forget this, I'm shutting down the government. Or Congress could fail to give him anything to sign or veto, and we're going to be faced with another government shutdown. I think one of the positives coming from the last shutdown is I think it gave the American public a greater understanding of who federal employees are and what they do, and government services that the American people rely on. Also coming out of that was legislation to ensure back pay for furloughed federal employees, which usually in the past has had to be signed by the president, passed by Congress, signed by the president. So now at least we know if there is another shutdown. I think we're all hoping and praying that there won't be. But if there is one, we do know that the furloughed federal employees will receive back pay along with the accepted feds.
What was also a teaching moment about the shutdown is that a lot of members of Congress who did not know that the Postal Service is not does not receive appropriated funds, in that the Postal Service remained open and the mail continued to be delivered despite the fact that part of the government shut down. So, in fact, God forbid there's a complete government shutdown, the Postal Service will still operate because it does not receive appropriated funds to operate.
Neither rain nor sleet nor shine. What's the saying?
Nor failure to pass a federal budget will stop the Postal Service from going on its rounds.
It will not. I'm always thankful when, say, D.C. has a snow day, right? The federal government is closed. The weather here is so bad. I can tell you each and every time my mail still seems to get delivered, and I think people have come to rely on that, and we thank you for it.
So as we move, we're going to be moving from the spring to the summer and into the fall when a budget needs to be enacted. Now, we spoke briefly about reconciliation. For those who are not familiar with the term reconciliation is when there are directions by the Budget Committee to individual authorizing committees like Oversight and Reform in the House and Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs in the Senate, and there were instructions to cut money from entitlements, not appropriations, but entitlements. That means health and retirement benefits. Jessica, do we see any chance of a reconciliation bill this year?
I think the short answer to that is no. I thought you were going to let your listeners be in ignorant bliss as to what reconciliation is. Sometimes I wish I was.
No.
No. So reconciliation is a process used to enact legislation that only requires a majority vote in the Senate, so 51 votes, instead of most legislation in the Senate, which requires 60. You use reconciliation when you know you don't have 60 votes, but you can pass something with 51.
And it's not subject to a filibuster.
It is not subject to a filibuster. It is how the Bush tax cuts passed in the early 2000s. It's how the Affordable Care Act passed in 2010, and it's how the most recent Tax Cuts and Jobs Act passed in December of 2017. You use reconciliation because it only requires 50 votes. This is big, big pieces of legislation. And there does not seem to be an appetite in Congress for any big piece of legislation this year. So I don't see a scenario in which reconciliation is used unless something like both parties, both chambers get on board with, say, an infrastructure package, right? We're going to improve our country's roads and bridges and do all the necessary repairs that anyone who's driven around D.C. knows that we most desperately need. But absent a big thing that needs to be paid for, I don't see a process through which reconciliation goes through.
So the instructions to our members out there is basically breathe more easily than you would have in previous years, but still be vigilant.
Remain vigilant. We tell them this all the time because things can change in a heartbeat, right? There could be any number of things that could happen, unforeseen events, and Congress is going to need some money. Mm-hmm. And your members and my members know all too well when they need to pay for something, they go to the federal community. So I think this is a year of less serious things. I think this is a year where we have an opportunity to play a little offense instead of just always defense, but we can't take our eye off the ball.
I'd like to shift a little bit onto government reorganization. And for my listeners out there, our listeners, we're not going to be talking about postal reorganization. We're going to be talking about reorganization with regard to the Office of Personnel Management. The Office of Personnel Management is currently run by an acting director who formerly was the deputy director of the Office of Management and Budget in the White House. And OMB is usually responsible for cutting benefits that our members benefit from.
I think she's actually dual-hatted right now. I think she's still the deputy director for management over at OMB and acting director. So, yes, conflict of interest is where you're going, perhaps?
Possibly, but it's the intent of the administration and their government reorganization plan to shift a lot of the functions of the Office of Personnel Management into the General Services Administration, who supposedly are managing the properties that are owned by the government.
They apparently have this untapped infrastructure that I've been unaware of all these years over at GSA to handle OPM's programmatic functions. So what do you mean when you say programmatic functions? That's retirement services, that's healthcare and insurance, including FEHB. It's things like the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey, most likely. Lot of ambiguity and lack of information about what this quote-unquote merger would look like. It's not a merger. It's a complete abolishment of OPM.
If OPM's function would move to GSA, what would be the impact on, let's say, FEHBP and FERS and Civil Service Retirement System?
So that's a great question because I don't think anybody knows the answer. I don't think this administration has provided proper justification for moving these programs to a different agency. In addition, I think we all recognize that OPM has some problems with retirement services, right? There's this pesky little cave in Boyers, Pennsylvania, where your records are kept. But most people agree that FEHB is run fairly well. It is a model program for healthcare programs across this country. So where is the inefficiencies? Where, the administration points to this reorg to make these programs more efficient. I'm not convinced that all these programs are inefficient. And even if they were, I don't think the administration has provided justification as to how they would then be less inefficient or more efficient over at GSA. A lot of missing information in this scenario.
The General Service Administration has no demonstrable competence in any of the key core sort of functions of the Office of Personnel Management.
No, not to my knowledge anyway. They buy and sell property, right?
They buy and sell property and manage property.
Apparently, their IT, what I understand is that their IT systems are a little bit more advanced than those of OPM, and that's a reason for this. But then I think if that's the reason, the administration needs to be more forthcoming about that.
There were those who think the move into the General Services Administration would be to more fully politicize the federal service. For those of us who are students of American history could recall that Teddy Roosevelt was involved in the Pendleton Act, which took sort of cronyism out of government services. And the Postal Service actually, in the 1970 Reorganization Act, depoliticized the Postal Service. But by putting benefits and human resource functions into the General Service Administration, there is an absolute fear that the civilian workforce and arguably postal benefits could be more politicized.
Absolutely. So under the proposed reorganization in the president's budget, civil service policy, federal personnel policy, would go to the executive office of the president, which is essentially OMB, right? Now, I think you could make the argument that when it comes to any sort of policy coming from the White House, it originates at OMB. So what difference does this make? But I think when you have civil service policy in an independent agency where the director is appointed, Senate confirmable, but appointed for four-year terms as opposed to a cabinet secretary, that there is less politicization. It matters less which party is in the White House. And I think the proposed move of personnel to the White House sets the stage for certainly a more political workforce.
Great. Well, that's about all the time we have for today. I want to thank Jessica for coming and joining us today. And I want to wish everyone a great weekend and a great week ahead. So with that,
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you. I'm going